This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anisha Rao, in for Frank Stacio. It's pretty likely that you or someone you know has experienced infertility. We don't talk about it publicly very often, but about 1 in 8 couples in the U.S. has trouble getting or staying pregnant. Today, we continue our series Embodied. We're talking about sex, relationships, and your health, and we're diving into the topic of infertility. We'll talk with doctors and advocates about who is affected and what causes fertility problems. We'll hear some personal stories, and we'll also look at some of the less visible parts of the conversation, like how race, ethics, and masculinity all play a part. We start with Dr. Stephen L. Young. He's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. He's also a physician at UNC Fertility. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
And if you would like to join the conversation, you can tweet at us with the hashtag embodied. So let's start with just some basic definitions and terminology. What do we mean when we say that someone is infertile?
So in the United States, the standard definition is someone who is trying to conceive for a year and has not conceived a pregnancy. And in Europe, that's called subfertility, recognizing that these same couples may go on to have a child. They just have a reduced ability to do so.
And we hear 35 as kind of this magic number. Is age an important part of this definition?
The woman's age, a woman whose eggs are being used, if you want to put it that way, age is very important. So peak fertility for a woman, unfortunately, is in the early 20s. And the latter 20s, there's a very small decline in fertility. But as we get into the latter 30s and early 40s, there's a more profound decline. And so women over 35 who've had trouble conceiving for 6 months are often evaluated, and it's recommended they be evaluated early rather than waiting a full year.
So what are some of the reasons why a couple could be experiencing infertility? Because this is not just to do with women.
Absolutely. So probably, certainly more than a third of couples, there's a male component, perhaps up to half. And there's some basic things that I think most of the listeners would know. There has to be sperm, there has to be eggs, there has to be a place for them to meet, which is the fallopian tube. So those have to be open to allow the meeting of the two. And then once an egg is fertilized and an early embryo is formed, it has to plant itself in the wall of the uterus, and all of those steps can go wrong.
So there could be something happening in the uterine lining. There could be a condition impacting the uterus or the ovaries, that kind of thing.
Correct.
Okay. So when we think about infertility treatments, IVF is obviously one of the most commonly known. How long has that technology been around?
So in the late 70s, the first delivery from IVF was achieved in England by Steptoe and Edwards and Purdy, the embryologist, not always mentioned. Soon thereafter, there was a birth in Australia, and soon thereafter in the U.S. in the early 80s. It was a research technique at the time. I believe there were over 300 tries before it worked in England. And so it was very, very inefficient. And then there was a rapid onset of changes, such by the mid-80s, it was much better. And then since from then to now, we've seen doubling or tripling of success rates, even from the mid-80s.
But this is not the first line of defense or the first step. So tell us about other kinds of assisted reproductive technology that would come into play before IVF.
Well, there are some things that absolutely do not require IVF. For example, if a woman is not ovulating regularly, sometimes an oral medication can cause her to ovulate, and that can simply be all that's necessary, taking an oral medication 5 days a month. And there can be insemination of the husband's sperm to get more sperm to the tube at the appropriate time. And that can be it's much cheaper than IVF, much less involved, and can be helpful in some cases. One can cause a woman to produce extra eggs per cycle, and that can boost a little bit the success rate, depending on the cause of infertility.
How about LGBT couples?
So donor sperm is widely available. There are sperm banks throughout multiple sperm banks in the country, commercial, that one can buy sperm. And we provide, as all clinics I think do, help for those couples by doing placing the sperm in the uterus near the tubes at the correct time. Sometimes the couples need ovulation induction. There's certainly health screening that needs to occur so that pregnancy health is optimized. So those are the kind of things that can help. Now, that's for same-sex female couples. Same-sex male couples face a much higher hurdle. They don't have a uterus between them to gestate. And so often they'll use a gestational carrier and a separate person donating eggs. So that's quite expensive and quite involved.
So we talked a bit earlier about this magic number of 35 for women's bodies. And there have been a lot of social shifts of women marrying later, couples choosing to have children later. All of this is going to come into the conversation. We talk about infertility. And a big, huge topic is egg freezing or embryo freezing. Can you talk about this technology,
sure,
where it is, and give us an overview?
So cryopreservation of eggs and embryos, cryopreservation of sperm.
Cryopreservation just means freezing.
It means storing at very cold temperatures.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
So there's a small difference between freezing and vitrification. Vitrification is induction of a glass-like state in the gametes or the embryo, and that is superior, been shown to be superior to traditional freezing. And so, you know, we make the differentiation. It's probably a small one. But that technology has actually helped us quite a bit in preserving eggs. So embryos are much easier to freeze. We usually grow them to 5 or 6 days of development. They have about 250 cells or so. And about half the cells are one sort and half the cells are another sort. And if you lose a cell or two in the freezing and thawing, it's no big deal. They don't seem to cause any troubles for the embryos. But you can imagine if you lose the one cell that's an egg, they're pretty precious and there are not that many of them. Sperm, on the other hand, you have millions or hundreds of millions, actually. And if you lose half, you don't worry too much about it. The other half can suffice. There's actually an egg freezing calculator, if people are interested, on our website, the UNC Fertility website. We've done some work in modeling when is a good time to freeze eggs. Certainly the earlier they're frozen, the more potential they have. However, the less chance the person will actually need them, because she may decide to have to get married and have a child in non-assisted ways. And so it's a tough decision point, and so that calculator that we have may be of some use.
We don't have much time left, but what are some of the most recent technologies or advances that have been made in fertility science?
Well, egg vitrification, certainly one of them. And I didn't mention that can be done also for women that are facing chemotherapy for cancer or other diseases, which might destroy the ovaries. The other advances are determination of which embryos are normal. Pre-implantation genetic testing allows looking at all the chromosomes with a pretty good accuracy now, say 98 to 99% accuracy. And so one can choose among many embryos the best one by finding which ones have normal chromosomal complement. That same technology can allow couples to avoid having a child affected by genetic disease, which is very helpful in an expansion of what we do. Assessment of the endometrium, of the lining of the uterus, is something that is ongoing, my laboratory hopes to contribute to that in the coming years.
Wonderful. Dr. Stephen L. Young is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the UNC School of Medicine and a physician at UNC Fertility. Thank you so much for talking with us. I want to bring in another fertility specialist to the conversation now, Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith. She is a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at Shady Grove Fertility in Atlanta. She's also a North Carolina native. Desiree, welcome to the conversation.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So there's a big cultural misconception that fertility is a wealthy white women's problem. That's not actually true. Tell us about this misconception and who is impacted by infertility.
So it is a stereotype that women of color are less likely to have infertility. And as practitioners, we definitely understand that that is not true. As Dr. Young mentioned, the first IVF pregnancies in this country happened in the early 1980s. And so the first campaigns about infertility treatments and awareness, unfortunately, did not include women of color. And so if you did not see yourself reflected in those advertisements or campaigns, then if you're a woman of color who was struggling to get pregnant, you just didn't even feel like those treatments were for you or targeted to you or were even accessible. So it kind of kept us out of the conversation early on as these treatments were developing.
Some of the statistics say that Black women are twice as likely to experience infertility, but then almost half as likely to access treatment. Can you tell me briefly about that, and then we'll continue the conversation?
Yeah, so there are some unique fertility factors that affect African-American women more than other ethnic groups. We have a higher incidence of uterine fibroids, which can impact how the uterus functions and fertility. African-American women are more likely to have tubal disease, blocked tubes from pelvic infections or from tubal ligation, and that can be a factor. We are more likely to be overweight or obese, and we know that that can affect our fertility, our ovulation, and our pregnancy outcomes. And when you look at women, Black women who've gone through fertility treatments, we are more likely to have had a longer duration of infertility before we seek treatment, and so we're older when we get there. And then our older age can also be a factor that limits our chance of being successful with those type of treatments.
Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith is a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at Shady Grove Fertility in Atlanta. She will stay with us as we continue our conversation about infertility. Today, it is Embodied, our series about sex, relationships, and your health on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Infertility is a disease that affects millions of Americans, but it's something that we rarely talk about in public. On this installment of our series, Embodied, we're taking a look at how infertility intersects with American culture. Still with us is Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith. She's a reproductive endocrinologist and an infertility specialist at Shady Grove Fertility in Atlanta. She's also a North Carolina native. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can tweet at us. Use the hashtag Embodied. So Desiree, before the break, we were talking about the particular experiences with Black women and why they're more likely to struggle with infertility. But there are also some barriers to seeking treatment in the Black community that I know that you've experienced firsthand with some of your patients. Could you share a little bit about that with us?
Absolutely. So it goes back again to the stereotype of what does a typical infertility patient look like. And unfortunately, the stereotypes are that African-American women are hyper-fertile. They're more likely to have multiple children, maybe need birth control, but not necessarily fertility treatments. And those stereotypes are placed upon the African-American community from the outside, but also they can be internalized by African-American women themselves. And so if you're a Black woman who's having trouble getting pregnant and you believe those stereotypes yourself, then you are going to internalize that. There's more shame and stigma to that. And you might feel like, well, everyone's fertile but me. So you don't want to reach out. You don't want to express that. And you're more likely to be isolated and to not seek the care that you need. Also from the medical community, if we have perceptions of what the fertility patient looks like, it can affect the referral patterns, where if we also believe that Black women are more likely to not have fertility problems, we may be more likely to tell that patient to just keep trying and you'll get pregnant, whereas another woman may be referred at an earlier time. There was actually a survey study of physicians asking which of these women, different scenarios, do you think are more likely to have infertility. Many of the providers selected the white woman, middle class, over the woman of color because of some of those biases, I believe.
So we spoke a little bit with Dr. Young about IVF. Are there treatment options available for men struggling with fertility issues?
Absolutely. So anytime we have a couple with a male and female partner, we stress the importance of evaluating both partners from the beginning. As you mentioned at the earlier part of the show, male infertility can occur in 30 to 40% of couples either on its own or in addition to a female factor. And so if we identify a sperm factor or an abnormality on a semen analysis, we want a man to have a urologic evaluation to look for any hormonal or anatomic abnormalities or causes for infertility. And then depending on the sperm abnormality, sometimes intrauterine insemination is a way to use the sperm and to place it in the uterus instead of having the natural travel of sperm from the vagina all the way to the fallopian tube. We also have in vitro fertilization, our IVF, where even if men have very low sperm counts or their sperm are less active, we can still be selective and get sperm and egg together in a laboratory and let them fertilize and still help men to have biological children.
We spoke with Dr. Young about egg freezing, and I know there are so many kinds of infertility tests out there, and there seems to almost be an increased conversation around encouraging people to take these tests and take them early. What is your philosophy on testing, and are there types that you think are more sound than others?
I agree that knowledge is power. So what we always talk about with any female patient I have, regardless of her age, is that women need to understand that we are on a timeline with our fertility from birth, actually. Men make brand new sperm every 72 days or so they can be fertile into their 50s, 60s, sometimes 70s. But for women, we are born with a limited amount of eggs, about a million at birth, and our egg count is slowly declining. By the mid-30s, that decline starts to become more rapid and more drastic, which is why we have that age 35 cutoff. And so for all women, just think about your fertility, think about your future fertility plans, and if you don't plan to have children then anytime soon, getting an assessment of your ovarian reserve is helpful. You can have an ultrasound at the beginning of a menstrual cycle to look at the ovaries and see how many follicles or little egg sacs are developing in the ovaries. There's a hormone test that can be done called AMH, which stands for anti-Müllerian hormone. It's a simple blood draw that will measure this hormone level in your blood, and that level is reflected of how much activity and follicle development there is in the ovary. So those are very easy things for a woman to do.
One more question for you. There's a lot of what maybe appear like pseudoscience out there about what you can do, what diets you can try, acupuncture, relaxation techniques, meditation. How much do all of those kind of lifestyle factors play a part in infertility?
I think that lifestyle and factors are important in general. We always want to, I'm a huge advocate for a plant-based diet, less processed foods, less fried food, fatty food, maintaining a healthy metabolic state and healthy weight before you pursue fertility treatments or pregnancy so that you can have a healthy pregnancy and healthier outcomes. So there's not a specific fertility diet, but I always advocate just more plant-based and a healthier diet and healthy weight. Many patients pursue acupuncture. Going through fertility treatments or infertility can be very stressful. And so yoga and acupuncture and these type of treatments or practices can be very good for just relaxation, stress reduction. Acupuncture can improve blood flow to the uterus and the ovaries. So I think that those things are also helpful for patients who are going through.
Dr. Desiree McCarthy-Keith is a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist at Shady Grove Fertility in Atlanta. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So we've been talking today about the science of infertility and some of the treatment options, but we're going to turn now to hear more about what it's like from a patient's perspective. Nichelle Sublett is a fertility advocate. She's also Mrs. North Carolina 2018. She uses her platform to share her struggle to get and stay pregnant and to encourage other women to start asking their doctors about fertility. She joins us from partner station WFAE in Charlotte. Nichelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Take us back to the beginning of your journey with fertility and infertility. When did you first realize that you were struggling?
About 6 months after I got married. So in April of 2013, got married to the love of my life and was very eager to start trying to have kids. But within about 6 months, we still didn't have any positive pregnancy tests. So we sought out the opinion of my OBGYN, and she diagnosed me with PCOS, or polycystic ovary syndrome.
And you have...
I know that...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to mention, I know Dr. Young spoke about that earlier.
Yes, I know, and you've been through such a wide range of treatments. I think you kind of joke about in your TED Talk that you have kind of a whole roster of things that you've experienced. Tell us a little bit about the steps that you have taken to address infertility issues.
Sure. Well, with my OBGYN, the first step was to get me to ovulate. So I was on an ovulation-inducing drug. And within a couple months, we were able to get pregnant. But unfortunately, I had a miscarriage in about 8 weeks when they couldn't find a heartbeat. And so from that point on, we went down this long road for about 5 years of genetic testing and fertility procedures, which ended up including 7 cycles of like the ovulation-inducing drug we mentioned, plus timed intercourse. We had 4 intrauterine inseminations, or IUIs, 2 IVF egg retrievals, pre-implantation genetic testing on our embryos, 3 frozen embryo transfers, 5 pregnancies. That included 2 with no fertility treatments. And all of this resulted in 5 miscarriages, 3 D&Es, and lots of money, so tens of thousands of dollars spent on treatments. And I know Dr. McCarthy Keith discussed the different diets. I also integrated gluten-free and dairy-free diets, acupuncture, fertility meditations. And for those who believe that vacations are the answer, we went on plenty of vacations. So,
wow. So you, buried in that story, you mentioned 5 miscarriages that occurred at all various stages of the pregnancy process. Can you talk a bit about the pregnancy losses and what that experience was like for you?
Yes, pregnancy loss is devastating. It leaves you completely heartbroken, a lot of times with no answers. You feel like you did something wrong to cause the miscarriage. As the woman, I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves and blame. And, it really is a death. I know some people may not understand that, but this is a child that you hoped and dreamed for and you had plans for, and you've probably mapped out half their lives by the time you see your positive pregnancy test. So it's absolutely the hardest thing my husband and I have ever been through, was going through those 5 miscarriages.
How did it change your relationship with your body and your relationship with intimacy?
I felt like my body was failing me time and time again. I felt like my husband couldn't really fully understand, since he's a man. Obviously, he was never going to be pregnant. And so this is something that we start thinking about as little girls, playing house or having fake weddings. So I think it's something that's ingrained into little girls from the beginning, that you're going to be a wife and a mother. And so when you can't do something that seems so biologically and basically easy, it's very frustrating, and you find yourself getting angry a lot.
I know that you mentioned your husband and the two of you and your ongoing relationship and working through this together. You are pregnant now. Tell us about that. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And what does that feel like after everything that you've been through?
Yes. So we were very fortunate to try one last embryo transfer. Last year, I won Mrs. North Carolina, and so we took a very long break of a year and just decided to enjoy the year. And at the end of that, we decided to try this one last frozen embryo transfer, because we do have frozen embryos, so we wanted to go ahead and use them. And that was the one that was successful. And we did that in December. I had a new reproductive endocrinologist who put me on a different protocol. And maybe the year away from it was very helpful as well, but I am now 34 weeks pregnant with a baby boy.
How are you handling this pregnancy psychologically because of everything that you've experienced and all the loss that you've experienced so far?
In the beginning, it was really difficult. I will say each appointment, while I think most people who are pregnant are very excited to go to, I was so anxious. I would start crying when I would get off the elevator and just literally bawl in the office with my doctor. And he was asking, well, is anything wrong? Have you had bleeding? And I'm like, no, I'm just scared to death. Mm. And I think until he started moving around and kicking and that type of thing within my uterus, it was incredibly scary every day, wondering if the baby was okay. Is the baby still breathing? Are we going to hear bad news at our next appointment? It's like you're always waiting for the other shoe to drop. And that was incredibly difficult every day. And it's still hard. I still wake up like waiting for him to move. Okay, we're good. I'm all right. But I need that reassurance all the time.
So you chose to go public about your story. You made talking about this a big part of your platform for Mrs. North Carolina. What has it been like to speak so publicly? Because as we've said so many times throughout this conversation, this is something that impacts so many people, but we're really pretty culturally silent.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, it was incredibly therapeutic and healing. I thought, again, I was really scared to go public and to make that my platform as Mrs. North Carolina, just because there is so much silence and it is very taboo, especially in the Black community. And so that was a huge step for me. But once I got it out in the public and started talking about it, it really opened up my eyes to the fact that so many other women were suffering with it, even women that I knew and knew closely. And it just opened up the conversation. So I would get lots of emails and text messages and people reaching out wanting to either meet for coffee or ask my advice about a friend who just went through a pregnancy loss. So I felt like I was able to really take that pain that I had been going through for 5 years and turn it into something positive to help someone else.
I imagine as you go through this again and again, year after year, it becomes harder to make the decision about, do we do this again? Do I keep trying? How much longer are we going to continue this process? Can you explain how you make those kind of decisions and what kind of advice you give to people who are in a similar position, who have struggled and maybe failed more than one time?
Well, I will say there was more than one time where we considered, or more I considered, wanting to just stop and give up and say, you know what, we've been through enough heartache, let's just live our lives childless. And the thing that kept me going was just, for one, my faith and remembering that there was a plan. I just hadn't seen the end of the plan yet. And also my husband, you know, he was extremely supportive and helped make these decisions along the way of saying, is this something you really want to stop? You know, we have these embryos that are frozen and they're there and they're waiting for us. And we had the testing done on them, so we knew they were normal. So a part of me felt like I'm already a mother to these embryos and it's really not fair for me to make them and then leave them in the freezer. So for me, I just had to keep going and see this thing through, because I felt like reading also through so many other women's stories just gave me so much hope and encouragement in continuing.
I'm talking with Nichelle Sublett, a fertility advocate in Mrs. North Carolina 2018. And I'd like to bring in another guest to the conversation now, someone else who has shared her story with fertility publicly. She is a professor in the Department of English and the director of the Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing at NC State. She's also the author of The Art of Waiting on Fertility, Medicine, and Motherhood. Belle Boggs, welcome back to The State of Things.
Thank you, Anita.
So you just heard Nichelle share her story. What resonates for you?
Oh, so much of what Nichelle was saying is so resonant for me and brings back those memories of isolation and loss and not knowing, as she said, what the plan is, and you know, not being able to see the end of your story or the next step of your story is one of the very difficult things about infertility. One of the things I realized when, like Nichelle, my experience was somewhat different, but it took me and my husband about 5 years to conceive our daughter through IVF, and if I had known at the beginning that things would be, that we would have the happy ending of our family, things would have been obviously so much easier. But that's the thing, when you're in it and you're in the within the experience of loss, of disappointment month after month, it's very hard. You don't have that perspective. You don't know what choices you'll make next. And for us, attending a Resolve support group was incredibly helpful. And there are many support groups around the country, including the website Fertility for Colored Girls has a great list of resources, and they also maintain support groups that are specifically, they're open, I think, to everyone, but they are specifically for women of color and can be a really great resource. They do podcasts and webinars and things like that as well. And Resolve is a national organization. We started going when we realized that we were infertile, we started attending a Resolve support group in Raleigh.
We're going to continue our conversation with Belle just ahead, but I want to say thank you and goodbye to Nichelle Sublett now. She's a fertility advocate and Mrs. North Carolina 2018. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about infertility. It is our series Embodied. You can find out more. You can join the conversation on Twitter with the hashtag Embodied. Belle Boggs stays with us just ahead. And we'll talk more about the roles that race, ethnicity, and masculinity all play in infertility. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao in for Frank Stacio. Today, it is our series Embodied. We're talking about sex, relationships, and your health. And we're exploring the topic of infertility today. Belle Boggs is still with us. She's a professor in the Department of English and the director of the Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing at NC State. She's also the author of The Art of Waiting on Fertility, Medicine, and Motherhood. So we heard Nichelle's story. You were sharing some of the parallels. And I want to take you back to the beginning of your journey a little bit and hear more about how and why you decided to choose IVF. And I really want to get into this question of cost. It's something that has kind of been at the periphery of our conversation this whole time, but IVF is incredibly costly.
Yes, and that's really important to bring up and address. So my husband and I started trying, I guess, when I was 32. And after about 1 year, we realized that it wasn't going so well, and I went to my regular OBGYN and asked for those tests, and then things seemed okay, and after that went back to my doctor and tried oral medication for a time. And so it took us about a year and a half or 2 years before we were ready to go to a specialist. And we actually saw Dr. Young. I remember the first time I met Dr. Young, and, you know, he was very encouraging, but also very frank and honest, and suggested to us that based on our history and all the tests that we'd had done, that IVF was probably the best course of treatment for us, the most likely to work. But for us, it was simply unaffordable. We had health insurance, but our health insurance did not cover fertility treatment. And in fact, only 16 states in the whole country have laws requiring health insurance companies to write fertility care into their policies. And North Carolina is not one of those states. So the cost just seemed daunting to us. And I was a public school teacher at the time. My husband is an attorney who works in public interest, and it was just not affordable. And so for some time, we tried intrauterine insemination and had the disappointment month after month of that not working. And then we took a break, and I was writing about fertility and infertility, and we were doing some research and trying to figure out what our path to family would be, because we knew that we wanted to have a family somehow. And eventually we decided that we had enough information and we were going to try IVF, and we got very, very lucky. So I have two daughters, 5.5-year-old and a 14-month-old, and they were both conceived through, their embryos were both created in the same IVF cycle.
But you more or less had to put your whole life savings on the line.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. And we would have had to do the same thing pursuing adoption of an infant, we realized, which is, another beautiful path to family that many couples and many infertile couples and individuals also pursue. But that also has financial challenges. And it's another thing where if we had a fully refundable adoption tax credit, that would help a lot of couples who are not high-income couples pursue that dream too.
Well, I think that's an important point, because people may be hearing this and think, well, why, instead of spending $8,000 to freeze your eggs or $15,000 on IVF, why don't you just adopt. And I know you've said that's one of the most hurtful things that you can say to a couple who's trying to get pregnant.
Yes, and I think it's also hurtful to adoptive families to hear just adopt. You know, there are many paths to creating a family, and they're all complicated, and especially all of the paths that require help. And they all require, you know, all of the paths in front of an infertile person or a person who has social infertility, which is a term I learned about recently from a New Yorker article in June by Anna Sussman, which is called The Case for Redefining Infertility. And that's it expands the definition of infertility to include anyone who has desired a family desired a child and a pregnancy, and for circumstantial reasons or because of their sexuality or gender identity, all of those things cannot. And I would say that it's pretty complicated for all of us.
I want to bring in one last guest to our conversation now, Liberty Barnes. She is a medical sociologist and ethnographer. She's also the author of Conceiving Masculinity, Male Infertility, Medicine, and Identity. Liberty, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Bell just introduced this term to us of social infertility. And this plays into some of the research that you have done and the work that you've done to kind of illuminate these less visible populations experiencing infertility. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. So I published a paper with my colleague Jasmine Flutter-Johan at the University of Lancaster, and we were looking at the statistics that we use in the United States to track infertility, and the statistics we've used since 1955. And when we look at these stats, we found that the study is reproduced every 5 to 10 years in waves. Women of color were not included in the study until the fourth wave, which wasn't until 1970. Men were not included until this century, until 2002. And there were no questions asking about the sexual orientations of the respondents until 2002. So a lot of the statistics that we rely on to create infertility provision for families who need medical assistance, we're using sort of historically inaccurate statistics. And thankfully, what we have now from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is pretty accurate. And what's coming out is, you know, the newer the statistics are, the more reflective they are of the people in our country who are experiencing infertility. But as Bell said, there are a lot of people who kind of fall by the wayside. They fall in the margins, and their experiences with infertility end up getting ignored by the medical system and even by society in general.
I want to hear now more about your research on masculinity. So as we've been saying throughout the show, men are just as likely to be contributors to an infertility problem in a couple than women, but we talk so infrequently about male infertility. So tell us about how and why you decided to start looking into this.
Okay, so I went through infertility treatments as well, like many of your guests today. And I have this story about my husband and I going in for an intrauterine insemination. And the night before the insemination, my husband spiked a really high fever. And keep in mind that any woman who's been through this knows that your doctor is tracking your ovulation with urine tests and ultrasounds, and you're trying to find like this perfect day that you can do your insemination. So we pin it down. It's going to be tomorrow, and he has this horrible fever. And we go in the next day, and the nurses take his sample, and they say, you know, all your sperm are dead. Like, the fever killed them all. And I just remember watching how carefully they were to encourage him. And they kept saying, you know, this is no reflection of who you are, and everything's going to be okay. And if you wait just 3 more weeks, everything's going to be fine. And I just remember sitting there thinking, like, feeling like chopped liver. Like, well, what about me? Like, no one was really worried about me. And And I had my own infertility issues that I was dealing with, and my husband has proven to be quite fertile. But it got me thinking about how men are understood in this infertility system. And so I did my doctoral dissertation research. I shadowed doctors who were andrologists. They were urologists, fellowship trained in male infertility. And I shadowed them, and I listened in on their clinical interactions with patients. And then I interviewed 24 couples who were dealing with male infertility. And I interviewed them, husbands and wives separately, and then again a year later.
What did you find?
So probably the biggest, most surprising finding that I had was that two-thirds of the men I interviewed did not self-identify as infertile. And I had been in their doctor's appointments. I had seen their test results, and they knew that too. I knew that these men had very low sperm counts. Some of them had zero sperm in their ejaculate. But when asked, do you self-identify as infertile? Two-thirds of them said, no, I just don't. Now, there was one-third of them who felt really sad, and they would say to me, you know, this was crushing. When I heard the results of my semen analysis, I cried. It was devastating. I felt like less of a man. But there were this other two-thirds of men that really intrigued me because they were experiencing infertility so differently than women do. And there's been so much sociological and psychological research on women and how hard infertility is for them. And these men seemed to have this really different perspective, which was, as long as there are medical treatments available, and until I've exhausted them all, I am not infertile.
That is so fascinating. So there are obviously these gender myths and gender conceptions that are really informing how we think about the medicine, and then also how people who are involved in treatments think about themselves. I wonder for you, what did you learn about the psychological burden on infertility for men?
Well, you know, I talked to a few psychologists who work in infertility, and they said, I said, what do I do with this interview data? Like, this was not what we were expecting to find. And some psychologists said, well, that's just really deep-seated denial. This is, you know, these men are completely out of touch. But when I went back and looked at my data based on my observations in the clinic, there was no point when the doctors said, I have bad news, you are infertile. What these men were hearing instead was, oh, shoot, you know, we wanted to see more, but we didn't see it. But that's okay, because now we're going to try this surgery, or now we're going to try this IUI. And in the situations where men had zero sperm, the doctors were saying, okay, so we didn't find any sperm, but we have this new procedure called in vitro fertilization with intracytoplasmic sperm injection, and we're going to take a sperm from your testicle, and we're going to get your wife pregnant. And so there was a lot of care in the medical system around protecting these men's masculine identities, I would argue, and that it was about making sure that men felt comfortable in the clinic, because as every doctor told me, it's so hard to get men to see a doctor in the first place, and they've finally shown up, and so you're not going to, you don't want to traumatize them. So there was a lot of care around taking care of these men, and in many ways it was shielding them from the reality that they were infertile.
Belle, we got a tweet from a listener who was essentially asking, how can husbands or partners better support their wives who are experiencing infertility? And kind of piggybacking off of what Liberty said, there seems to be a lot of effort in a clinical setting to preserve the masculinity of men who may be experiencing infertility. And we know, obviously, through Nichelle's story and some of your own experience, infertility can really impact your own kind of sense of your womanhood or your femininity. So what can a support network, a community, or a partner do to support a woman experiencing, if the infertility is related to her own body?
Well, I think that, first of all, my husband and I, we both experienced different facets, but we were jointly infertile. But I think that, you know, one of the things that couple can do is to consider infertility the joint problem, no matter whose body, wherever the disease originates, because it is, although it's not covered by insurance, it is a disease. Infertility is a disease that should be covered by insurance. But thinking of it as a joint problem, and then also you know, offering to go to the support group together, going to the support group, not just as an offer to, oh, let's go together, but you might learn something. One of the things that I really liked about my support group and that I know my husband Richard also really liked is that there were male partners there too. And it was not only, the women were the ones who were getting the shots and going to all of the, sometimes unpleasant appointments, but the men were there to talk about what they had experienced and what it was like for them and, also to support their partners. And I think that was really helpful.
Liberty, I know that there have been some interesting studies that have come out in the past couple of years talking about sperm and sperm counts and I guess research essentially that sperm count and success is lessening over time and around the world. I wonder your perception on this and how this is impacting the industry and research.
Oh, this is a good question. I'm not a biologist, but I can tell you that in 1992, there was a famous Skakabak study that came out and said that infertility, male infertility around the globe was declining by 40%. And then for about the next, 20 years, scientists in smaller studies tried to disprove this. And about 5 years ago, it was essentially considered debunked, that hadn't been true. And then in the last 2 years, a new study came out that said, no, Skakabak and his researchers were correct. So what does this mean? I think, for a lot of men, if their infertility declines by 40%, they can still get their wife pregnant because some men have 100 million sperm and you really only need 20 million to achieve pregnancy. So I don't want all the male listeners to run out, panicked that they're never going to be able to have children. But it does mean that we're going to have to start discussing this more openly, that there can't be a taboo around male infertility, and that the medical system probably needs to. One of the things I write about in my book is that if we worked so hard to protect men's masculinity, we actually end up only hiding male infertility more. And we need to probably have some open dialogue and say male infertility is a real thing. And a lot of men experience it. And if you're experiencing it, you're not alone. To help men seek medical help, which also is a great boon to women, because a lot of women feel like I am bearing the brunt of our infertility. And this would be really helpful if my husband could, do things to improve his fertility and to be more involved in this. So I would say ultimately we need to have a more open dialogue like this show today and encourage men to do something that is really good for them and good for their wives.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much. Liberty Barnes is a medical sociologist and ethnographer. Belle Boggs is a professor in the Department of English and the director of the Master of Fine Arts Program in Creative Writing at NC State. You can find out more about them and everyone we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.